Hello, hello, this is Alex Burkett, and you're listening to the Long Game Podcast. In this episode, we are having a conversation with David Cadavy. David is an author, a podcaster, and a self-publishing coach. He's the author of three books, The Heart to Start, Design for Hackers, and most recently, Mind Management, Not Time Management. His podcast, Love Your Work, features both interviews with experts like Seth Godin, James Altucher, and Dan Ariely, as well as solo monologues on topics like the barbell strategy, which is a particular concept that David and I share an interest in and which we discuss in the conversation that follows. He also runs a newsletter that goes out every Monday called Love Mondays that is super inspirational and filled with his thoughts and his best gems that week for creatives. If I had to sum up David, I think it would be as a creator or a creative or potentially a clear thinker. Writing appears to be his preferred medium, but he seems to me to be mostly interested in ideas, creative concepts, and changing hearts and minds, and he's clearly effective at doing that through multiple mediums. Now, we met because David had actually stumbled serendipitously upon an article that I wrote about called The Barbell Strategy. That one was with regards to content marketing in specific. And we realized after we had chatted through emails and through a couple conversations that we had tons of similar interests and influences. So this conversation dives into his background, growing up in Nebraska, moving to Silicon Valley, and eventually to Medellin. We also cover productivity advice for creatives, the creative sweet spot, anti-optimization, convergent versus divergent thinking, streaks for productivity, and way, way more. So I really think you're going to enjoy this one. Without further ado, here is David Cadavy.
How long have you been doing your podcast?
5 years. About the same amount of time that I've been here in Columbia. I did my first few interviews while I was still living in Chicago. And released the podcast kind of just before I moved to Columbia and then moved down to Columbia. And then from then on, it's been like recording from my closet.
Did you have any goals with the podcast when you started it, or has it evolved in sort of a natural way?
Yeah, it's definitely evolved in a natural way. And it's certainly evolved in ways in which I had to recalibrate based upon my initial expectations. I don't know what my goals were. I guess it was more that I liked listening to certain podcasts. I enjoyed listening to the Tim Ferriss show. I enjoyed James Altucher's show, but I still wasn't hearing exactly what I wanted to hear. And so that was kind of my primary thing, was to make a podcast that is what I want to listen to. And with thinking in mind that if I reach a point where I realize that there is something that I want to listen to and I can't do it better, then I won't do it anymore. And I've kind of done that, in that I initially was doing interviews. I had interviews with a lot of great people, David Allen, Jason Fried, huge list. And I've kind of gotten to the point where I've thought, well, there's a lot of really good interview podcasts out there. That's not necessarily like the thing that I want to be doing anymore. And so as I was preparing to launch this latest book, Mind Management, Not Time Management, I decided not to do interviews. And so I've just been sharing my own ideas as essays. And I don't think I'm going to go back to doing interviews. I might do like a few here and there, but I don't think it's going to be like a regular thing for me, just because I don't feel that I have necessarily a lot to add in that area. In part because those who are really good at interviews, like it's an art, and to get really good at it and to be able to attract the type of people that you want to talk to as the market sort of saturates, it gets harder and harder. Like for me to get Nassim Taleb on my podcast is like not going to happen probably, or to have Jerry Seinfeld on my podcast, not going to happen, I don't think. And so I'd much rather, you know, maybe read some books and do a Nassim Taleb summary or something such as that. So I'm currently just sharing my own ideas on it. It's my intellectual playground, which I think has kind of been it from the beginning. And now I'm starting to accept that that is what it is. And I'm not so concerned about downloads. I don't even take sponsors. I've got enough Patreon supporters to keep it going at the level that it's going. And I'm just enjoying myself.
I like that idea of the podcast as an intellectual sandbox of sorts. But when you started it, it sounds like you had some idea in terms of like what the market wasn't delivering. Was that just the people that were being interviewed, or was that the conversation style, or what gap did you want to plug when you kind of started out down that path with interviews?
Yeah, I think at that time it was more about, there was just seemed to be this obsession with like peak performance. You know, so James Altucher at the time was like peak performance. I don't know what he says he offers now. And then Tim is like world-class performers. And something about that, I'm not into. I don't know whether that was just me like self-handicapping, because I don't like the challenge of trying to become a peak performer or a world-class performer. I'm much more interested in arriving at the point where you're doing this thing that nobody else can do, which is in a way peak performance, I guess, but I'm more interested in the, how do you find your own voice? How do you go off the beaten path and find yourself in this place where now suddenly nobody can do this thing that you're doing. And so that was what I wanted to learn from my guests. And I think I did, that was another part of it, is that I evolved so much myself from those conversations and the things that I learned, that I kind of reached the point where I was like, all right, well, I don't actually want to consult anybody anymore. I want to lean more into what is it that I have, what am I thinking, what's going on in my mind, and what do I have to offer?
There's something strange about the word performers in that context. Like, I've noticed that same thing. I think it was Art of Charm, Jordan Harbinger, his new podcast, he always says like, you know, seeking the art of high performance or something like that. And it implies that there's like an audience and competition and like a rigorous kind of structure. But it seems like even your process of productivity differs from that, I don't know, tunnel vision performance, checklistization of productivity. Like, it seems like in mind management, that kind of feels like the whole point of the book, at least like from what I've read so far. It's like different and getting new creative work put out instead of like the linear.
Yeah, path. And it actually took me a while to arrive at that realization too. And it's good that you mentioned Jordan, because he's somebody who is an interviewer, and he's interviewed Shaq and mm-hmm. he gets these big guests and like, that's the thing, you know, he studies old tapes of Larry King doing interviews, and like, that's the thing he does. And I'm not going to become as good as he is at it. And certainly not for as broad of an audience as he is serving, because when you get to that broad audience, that's what people are interested in, is the sort of thing that you're doing when you're playing the America game, which is like almost this sense of desperation, which is understandable because it's hard to survive in America. Of like, I've got to get more. I've got to be the best at the top of my field, and it's, there's less emphasis there's less emphasis, less appreciation for what I see as more of an artistic process of finding what it is about you that's unique and getting really good at that, like doing the, I guess Naval would call it your specific knowledge, like keep changing what you do until you are the best in the world at whatever it is that you're doing, because you're also the only person who's doing that. And so it is an iterative process, and doing the podcast has been that sort of exploration where I did finally arrive at the point like, oh, this is what I'm trying to do, is that we do have this unique challenge where if it is the checklist type of procedural step-by-step way of getting things done, well, there's no point in being really great at that, because if it can be done step-by-step, then it's going to be automated. A robot's going to be doing it. Like, there's no point. You have to figure out what makes you as a human unique. And we all have something, but the way that people talk makes it impossible to see how to make that happen. And it's not easy. You know, I'm still trying to figure it out. And I think this is one of these things that takes a longer, you need a longer runway for it. You need more space. You need a lot of opportunity to screw up and try things and still somehow stay in the game and not go bust. And so, yeah, I think that it does tie into what I'm saying in the book, which is basically, well, productivity isn't any longer about doing things faster or even better. It's about arriving at quality ideas.
Yeah, what's interesting to me there is, I think talking about these peak performers, there's this implicit message of, if you can do X, Y, Z, you can become a peak performer, which kind of gets to this checklist that you're talking about. And if it is a checklist, everyone can do it. It's not really special. And it sounds like what you're saying is there's this journey where you have to arrive to where you're supposed to be, which caught my ear. You're saying arrive a lot, implying that
I didn't even realize that. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah,
I
there's a process and a series of experiences that one must go through in order to figure out what you're good at, and no hack or body hacking or mind hacking or anything like that is going to really get you there unless if you go through that process to figure out what it is you need. That's sort of my big takeaway here, which is a really interesting reframing.
To borrow from Naval again, I think he said something like, you know, you can't teach it, but you can learn it. You know, but you've got to find your own way. You've got to throw away the map. You got to get lost. And like, it's just not going to work out step by step. There's not a guarantee there either.
Ava, do you consider yourself primarily a writer, or how would you define yourself? And I know that probably changes or it's nuanced, but like, what would you tell other people you do?
I just say writer. Now, it wasn't something that I arrived at being a writer by accident. I was more interested in art and design. I wrote a book about design. Then I was involved with entrepreneurship, and I arrived at this point where I realized, well, writing is not something that I was innately passionate about, but it is a creative process, much like art or design. And I felt like the way that design was going, it was becoming kind of a commodity. Mm-hmm. And I realized, well, with the lifestyle that I want to live, I don't want to deal with clients. I want to be location independent. I'm apparently decently given some kind of gift with writing, because it wasn't something that I enjoyed doing as a kid or anything. I guess I got to this point where I said to myself, well, yeah, if I could just keep doing this every day, I enjoy it enough. It affords me to do the types of activities day to day that I'd like to do, which is basically just sit and read and think about stuff. This is a good path to go down, especially given that when I was doing design and writing about design, I was thinking, well, the value out of design is that humans have to interface with computers. And we don't have brain to computer interfaces. So the visual interface is the best way to do that, to reduce the friction between I have a thought and I'm going to get this computer to do a thing. And now I see it as, now there's like libraries for designing. The field has advanced in ways that I look at that there's an Apple TV app for my smart TV. Like, I'm so glad I don't have to think about there being 100 different apps for something. But words are like, they're platform independent. You know, you can put them in anything. You can put it in a Kindle book. You can put it in a paperback. You can cut it up into tweets. You can put it on an Instagram post or something. And it affects people's minds. You know, you can invest all this time and effort in creating an app. And a lot of apps, it's like, well, there's not a value add there. Really, it's the mental operating system that's important. And so I also saw that as like a way to kind of contribute the way that I would like to contribute to humanity, which is to change people's thoughts. And I can just do it with like words, and the words are platform independent. They can go anywhere. And the activities of allow the lifestyle that I'd like to lead, et cetera. So it's sort of how I ended up being a writer. And so that is primarily what I think of myself as.
That's super cool. So way back before you considered yourself a writer, you were writing books on design and probably blog posts and all that too. What drove that?
Well, I was in a gray cubicle in Nebraska in 2004, and I was a designer, and I had desperately wanted to get out of Nebraska, but I failed at that, and then after college, coming back to Nebraska and getting a job in Omaha, wanted to get out. And I was reading all these blogs. I was reading Seth Godin. I was reading Douglas Bowman, who went on to be a designer at Google and Twitter. Also David, I mean, a lot of these people you might not even remember, but I was reading all these blogs and I was just thinking like, oh, I want to start a blog too. It'd be so nice to like, just sort of reach out into the world, which was kind of something that I always wanted to do because I grew up in a cul-de-sac in Nebraska where the only friends pre-internet. So it's like the only friends you can have are people who live in your neighborhood. And so I definitely like wanted to reach out into the world. And so I just started a blog on Blogger. And then I started using that blog to practice web design. And you can still see the first blog post that I wrote. It's terrible. It's a run-on paragraph. There's a misspelling in it. In it, I'm talking about how, I don't know why I'm doing this, but I just want to like barf it out there. I don't want to get paralyzed over my own perfectionism, etc. And sort of one thing led to another. That was my playground for practicing design. And you know, roughly a year later, I got discovered by a startup in San Jose, and they moved me out to Silicon Valley, and that's where I worked for a few years and got exposed to the whole entrepreneurship world. I remember him talking about how he was raising money from a VC. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, and so I did that for a few years, and then I had learned how to sort of believe in myself from living in Silicon Valley, because growing up in Nebraska at the time, if you had weird ideas or had personal interests, people were very mystified by that. You know, I remember starting my blog and my friends being like, well, why are you doing that? Is somebody paying you to do that? Like, that's actually how people think. Like, you got to tell me what to do. Somebody's got to pay you to before you're going to do something. You wouldn't like just do a thing like just because you want to. Like, that's crazy. Why would you do that? And so, and it sounds so ridiculous now, because I think this culture of entrepreneurship has spread to places like Nebraska or Omaha. I'm sure it's completely different there, but at the time, at least, it was certainly like that. So I had I had achieved, I had arrived at this point where I was, I could believe in myself, and I understood this like ask for forgiveness, not for permission thing. And when you have an idea to pursue it, but I came to the realization living in Silicon Valley that I didn't want to do this sort of VC scale thing where you've got to raise a bunch of money and then you hire a bunch of employees. I don't really like working with people. I like to be independent. I don't want people breaking my toys. And so I left Silicon Valley in 2008. And it was, I didn't really have a plan, went to Chicago. It was going to be cheaper rent. And I just wanted to, give myself some space and explore whatever was in my mind, just whatever ideas I had. And so I moved to Chicago. I build like 10 hours a week to clients in Silicon Valley. And then the rest of the time I tried to build passive revenue streams. And then on top of that was just what I called speculative, was I'll just play and see whatever I come up with. Well, 3 years of being on my own was the point at which I wrote a blog post. It was very popular. It was top of Hacker News. And I got an email from a publisher saying, hey, would you like to write a book about this? And I said, yes, this is what I've been waiting for.
That's fascinating about the origin story in Nebraska. I think you and I have talked about this before, but I grew up in small town Wisconsin, and entrepreneurship was like the local like gas station owner or like the, I don't know, construction guy or something like that who had his own business.
You hook up a snowplow to your truck and you go clear people's driveways for, you know, $5 a piece or whatever. And, you know,
the paradigm was so small in terms of like things you could feasibly do for a living. Mm-hmm. I remember my big turning point was going to college and realizing that a couple friends were building their own startups. Some were writing, some were like teaching piano and like just doing interesting things that I thought like, oh, I didn't know you could make money, good money doing these things. Yeah. So it sounds like that was your moment once you started blogging. While still in Nebraska, it seemed like when you basically got that job offer, you're like, wait, something came of this. Like this is, there's something to this, even though I didn't see it before.
Yeah, I don't know. There was some foresight there. I certainly like there were people in Nebraska doing creative things. Like there was one big inspiration was a record label called Saddle Creek Records. And I don't know if you're familiar with Connor Oberst or Bright Eyes. They came out of Nebraska, and you know, I would run into them at a bar or something, and you know, we weren't like buddies or whatever. I had a friend who played in a band on that label, but it was cool. They were, you know, they were on a global stage. Like my friend would just go leave for 6 weeks because he was touring in Asia or Europe playing drums, and so there was that sort of inspiration, and there were some people involved with that label who had websites and were not doing the great cubicle thing. And I was sort of mystified, like, do these people make money? Like, I couldn't figure out how to like make friends with them or anything, but at least it was an example that at least got me thinking like, okay, I need to like put my little spot on the web. And at first it was just flash experiments. There was this plugin called Macromedia Flash. I don't even think it was Adobe. It might not have been. I don't know. But they're just like made little flash toys on my website. That was like 2003, maybe. And then eventually did the blog on Blogger and then migrated it over. And I do remember having thoughts like, oh, you know, like when I drive by Warren Buffett's house and he's got that house that he bought for, I don't know what, $30,000 or $40,000 over on Farnham and Dodge. And now that house is worth like, I don't know, $700,000 or, you know, back at least early 2000, like, well, maybe that's something like that will happen on the internet where I can just kind of be like, this is something I can like pass on to my grandchildren or like, just like grab this plot here. Because everybody was telling me to buy a house. They're just like, oh, we got to buy a house. Yeah, it's the best investment you can make. you know, God's not making any more lands. Like, I don't know. Something's weird here. This is early 2000s when everybody's getting mortgages and, you know, a few years before the real estate crash. And like, I don't, that doesn't sound right, especially because so many people are telling me this. It makes me even more skeptical. Maybe it's something on the internet here. So I did have some foresight there that like I realized I was in some kind of a momentous like time where like there was this explosion happening that I could see that a lot of people couldn't. I can't say I capitalized on it really great, other than that I did buy Google and Apple stock, which have been very important to allowing me to even pursue the path that I have.
So I'd love to ask more about your move to San Jose and the words you used. You said, I learned how to believe in myself.
Yeah.
I want to know more about that lesson and like if there's any fundamental things that happened out there, if it was just a bunch of mistakes that you made. Because I think it's interesting you use the language like learned how to believe. Some people don't. Yeah. They're not born with that.
Oh, absolutely. Because I didn't believe in myself. You know, I didn't grow up in an environment where, oh, you have an idea, like you should pursue that. It's more like, oh, you have an idea, like you're weird. You have an idea. What's wrong with you? Or you even at work, you might be like, hey, you know, we could try this or whatever. They're like, ah, no, you can't that thing. And this, oh, we should talk to a lawyer first, or, you know, shooting everything down. Just a very closed-minded, fearful culture. Primarily, you know, not everybody's that way, but like, especially like the office I was in, when I told people I was moving to California, I didn't hear like a single good thing about it. Hardly. It was like, oh, the people are so different there. I'm like, yeah, it's the idea. The traffic is horrible. If you ever watch the movie Nebraska by Alexander Payne, who is from Nebraska and who's obviously a very creative person, the language that is in that movie is just so exact, because the people are like, they just want to know the gas mileage that the car gets and is this a good deal and et cetera. There's no creative pursuits at all. And so when I get to California, first of all, there's just this sort of crazy entrepreneur guy who discovered me in Omaha. And I realized having conversations with him, like I might have an idea and be like, yeah, okay, we should do this. And they would, you know, we would do it. Maybe it didn't work, but we would do it. I remember being in, arriving there in California and having, I had, you know, programming skills and design skills and working in the sort of corporate gray cubicle world, it was like, oh, you're young, you've got to pay your dues. There wasn't any appreciation of what you have as somebody who can master this technology that's currently changing the world in 2003, 2004. And so to arrive in California and to suddenly have my opinions or my ideas be treated as if they have value was a revelation. A lot of it was this world that I had pictured might exist and realizing that, yes, in fact, it did exist. Because for the longest time, being in Nebraska, I thought, this doesn't add up. How, like, I feel like I've got something here.
Yeah.
But nobody else seems to believe that. And so I didn't believe it. But then once I was in the valley and got treated with respect and had my ideas treated with respect and was in this environment where I would have an idea and then my friend would be like, we're doing this today. And they would push you and you would go do it. Yes, that was just such a huge catalyst of personal growth mm-hmm. to just simply have your own belief in your ideas reinforced.
Mm. It sounds like environment plays a big role in a lot of your paradigm shifts. I know the Chicago to Medellin one played a big role in the mind management book. I believe your words were you wanted to be a mind in a brain in a jar on Mars. So that was one environmental shift, the shift from Nebraska to San Jose, and that you were allowed to like let your creativity flourish and not have it stamped out. So would you say that environment plays a pretty big role in mind management and productivity, output, performance, whatever you want to call like that kind of like end result that you're seeking?
For me, I don't know if that's true for everybody. I feel like I'm particularly malleable, particularly influenced by my environment. And that is something that you see that as you change your environment enough times, and especially for a while, I was coming here for a few months and then I would go live in Chicago for a while and I'd come here for a few months. And there'd be sort of things I would notice about myself that I was a different person in these different places. And as much as one environment might shape me into a certain way, I'd come back to the other environment and think, all right, now I need to like hold on to this. And you just slowly become this other person as hard as you're trying not to. Mm-hmm. And some of it stays eventually over time. Some of it stays almost like you're doing you're etching something, dipping it in an acid bath or whatever. I do think environment is important. And that is one of the reasons why, as I've experimented with this idea of separating myself from the time management paradigm, it's been so important to be here in Colombia. I don't know how I would do it in the United States. Even as much as I've driven it into my mind, I think it would be tricky. Here in Colombia, it has just a completely different conception of time. And it's challenging for me even because I have that programming to be a little impatient, to be in a little in a hurry, and to value time the way that North Americans do. So the environment is really important, and that extends to how I might design my home office or the way I change my environment throughout the day as I try to be in various mental states for doing different types of work.
Is this a simple delineation between, I think there's, I can't remember the academic's name, but she has this concept of tight cultures and loose cultures, and tight cultures are going to be more rigid. They're going to be more, demanding on your time. So like if you're 2 minutes late, like it's a big deal. And then loose cultures are going to be a little bit more free flowing. There's probably more dancing at family celebrations. Is that kind of like the central paradigm that kind of creates openness for creative output? Like just being a more open culture, having less of, I think the word you used in your book was time pressure. So you've got like a 30-minute meeting. You can't go over, you can't read any longer than that because you've got to be here at this time. Do you think that's kind of the main thing, the main difference between the US and Colombia now?
I'm not familiar with the concept that you're talking about. I am familiar with clock time, event time.
That I love that concept. Yeah.
Something that I've certainly noticed, and that is that a culture like the United States is based clock time. We want things to happen at certain times. We want to know how long is this going to take? How long am I going to be waiting in line, etc. A place like Colombia is of event time culture, and it's just this thing happens and then that thing happens and then this other thing happens. If this other thing doesn't happen before this, we do this thing. And one way to think about it is that like in Colombia, if somebody wants to have a weekly appointment with you, or that you just had an appointment and you're going to see them again in a week, they'll say en ocho días, in 8 days. All right. And so when I first heard this, I'm just like, this is wrong. What are you talking about? Like this is going to be, the earth is going to rotate 7 times. And like, who am I to say that this entire culture has decided, has like, are doing it wrong? But that's like what your mind says. Like that doesn't, that's not, that's just wrong. It's not 8 days. It's seven rotations of the earth. And it wasn't until I learned about event time that it started to make sense, which is that today is an event. There's 6 days between now and the mm-hmm. next appointment. Those are each events. And then the day of the appointment is another event. That's 8 days. 2, 1 + 6 + 1, 8 days. 8 días. And so when you're trying to think creatively, you are connecting disparate concepts. It's almost like a racquetball court with balls flying around. They have to run into each other. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're going to have an insight that's good. Sometimes you're going to have one that's not that useful, but you have to kind of experiment and figure it out. Well, when you're doing procedural stuff, it's fine to go by the clock. Frederick Taylor, who created scientific management, sat there with a stopwatch next to industrial workers, broke down every single motion. If somebody was putting up a brick wall, they would even have like a person who just put the scaffolding up so that that person didn't have to stoop down to grab the brick. They would just pick up the brick, put it here, like follow these exact motions, follow these exact steps. You're going to get the brick wall up faster. Well, we still have that mentality, but work has changed so much to where if, you know, there's machines that can put up brick walls, I'm quite certain. If you can just follow a series of steps, it can be automated, a machine can do it. It's the quality of your ideas that matter. I think it was Naval that said this, that, you know, Warren Buffett spends a year deciding and one day acting. Mm. Warren Buffett, my former neighbor. it's the decisions, the quality of the decisions that you're making. It's the actual execution doesn't take that much time at all. So you need a lot of space. There's no way to rush this process of arriving at that point where you're making a good decision, where you have a good idea. And so if you're creating some sort of a board or a deadline that you have to rush to beat, you're putting yourself in an anxious state. Mm-hmm. Well, an anxious state is a killer of creativity. We want to be relaxed, positive mood. These things promote creativity. These things promote insight. But when you're in like a vigilant state, you're watching the clock. That's a little better for, yeah, maybe if you're like correcting the spelling on a paper or something, but just use Grammarly or something instead. And that's the type of culture that we have here, is that it is very much present moment focused. And this is one of the things that Ann Lars Selyer and Amar Tabnet, yeah, when they looked at clock time and event time people, found that one of the things that event time people were able to do is they're better able to seize opportunities that come to them in the moment. Like say, if you say, oh, we're going to give you a free vacation, but you have to go next week. Well, if you're a clock time person, you're like, I got all this stuff scheduled. If you're an event time person, you're more present with what's happening in that moment. And that is great for creativity, because you never know when you're going to have these insights that you then want to execute on them. So if you already have some sort of plan about all the things you're going to be doing, then you're not able to be present with those opportunities. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this echoes super hard for me, because I'm always ranting about this. If I have a meeting at like 10 a.m., you could say like I could wake up at 6:30 and I have a couple hours of creative free time, if you will. I can write whatever. But I look at that calendar and it gives me anxiety, because I'm like, I have to like wrap up at a certain time. I have to like prepare for this meeting. So I end up getting either no creative work done, or my creative work is not as good as I would like. So a kind of compromise, it's hard to fight uphill against culture, and especially if you work at a large company, because everybody else has incentives, and those incentives tend to be appearing busy. So you throw time on other people's calendars, you externalize your own. you know, sort of incentives on appearing busy onto others' calendars. So then you get a stacked calendar. So it's hard to fight against that. So what I've done is this concept called Sacred Saturdays, where I just wake up and I have no plans. Like, I never plan anything on Saturdays. And if I want to work, I can. If I don't want to work, I don't have to. If I want to go for a walk, I'll just go for a 3-hour walk. And it's been amazing. I've gotten my best work done on these Sacred Saturdays. And I think, David, you've started doing them as well, just for basically like stress management, right?
Yeah, I do deep work Wednesdays. So entire day is blocked off for no meetings. Granted, something sometimes slips in and I make sure it's at the end of the day. And I now have these Sacred Saturdays as well. I go on a 4-hour walk and no music or anything, just walking, observing some birds, sipping some coffee, watching some people just arguing maybe on a street or something, but just not pressuring myself to do anything. And I think that's been helpful space for that creative thinking and connecting those nodes that I wouldn't otherwise have noticed connections for.
There's a concept, I think, in the book on convergent and divergent thinking. Does that open space play into that, where it's like you kind of need, you know, you have all the time preparing and researching and, you know, sitting down, focused work, and then you kind of need to lift your head up and go walk or take a shower or something for the actual concept to converge? There's something about that space, right?
Well, certainly like the divergent process is a process sort of collection of allowing your tentacles to reach out into the world and collect what they will. Like David was saying, going on a walk, no phone, no, you're not listening to a podcast, you're not taking a call, you're just kind of looking around. And maybe even I try to do this where like you might have a walk and you have a destination in mind, but allowing yourself to say, oh, well, wait, no, I want to go over here now instead, and exploring in that way. Whereas the convergent process is sort of the whittling down of, all right, well, I think of it like when I go on a vacation often, when I first arrive at a new location, I don't know what it is about me. I want to like walk around and like see what there is the first, like as soon as I get there.
And that's the divergent process?
Right. And then I feel a little more secure with like, all right, well, to have a successful vacation, I want to be able to do that and that and that. And I can feel secure that I'm not like missing out, right? Mm-hmm. Which that could go as a whole other way. Maybe it's not good to have that FOMO necessarily, but it does mitigate it for me. So the convergent process is more like whittling down of things, is that you've got an idea what your options are and you're homing in on one of them.
Do you consider with writing as an example, is the research the divergent process? Is the editing the convergent process? Writing seems like it could hit a little bit of both of those, depending on how you're writing.
I was gonna say, I've started, especially when I have to pull together like interviews and data points and all these disparate pieces of information, I'll spend like a big chunk of time just absorbing it. And then I have to go away from my computer. If I have the time,
because
yeah. And I've gotten some of my best ideas, especially when the piece needs some of my own opinion in it. Cause I can't produce my own opinion in like, if I'm switching between a data piece and then a Google Doc, I have to like let it all come together. So it reminded me with the whole, the walking and the convergent process, that's something that's helped me a ton. Cause you get so close to it, it doesn't make any sense. Like you can't do anything but just regurgitate what you've read. Mm-hmm. So that's what it related to me the most when it comes to writing.
I once wrote an article on brand awareness and I had to spend 3 months kind of chipping away at the writing. Like I would write a paragraph and be like, oh, I don't know this well enough. But I was mainly just thinking and researching and reading because I didn't know what the term brand awareness meant at a core level. Like when people said that, it was kind of like meaning all these different things. Mm-hmm. So I actually had, now that I have these words to use and frameworks to apply, it was like a whole divergent process before I actually sat down. And when I understood, when I like had my own ideas in my head, it was so fast. Like I just wrote it and it was like done. But like the 3 months before that was so laborious and just like, I don't know, information gathering and synthesizing and all that stuff.
There was something else in your book, David, you said that we've associated productivity with producing, and like having an output, like even a tangible output. And I personally, that's like, if I have a productive day, I wrote a ton of words or I had a ton of meetings, and I need to stop associating that, because going on a walk for 4 hours, thinking through everything you just learned, like that's also productive, right? Because then you can sit down and write a piece in 30 minutes. So mm-hmm. you have to start associating productivity with less. Personally, I need to stop associating it with so much tangibility.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you're optimizing for too. And this is something that I think about as a writer. As recently, I've been reading a lot of Naval, as I've mentioned him a couple of times, but he just helped me realize that I'm leveraging media. There's three types of leverage: capital, labor, media. So if I'm leveraging media, I can reach millions of people just moving my thumb on my phone and publishing a tweet. If that tweet is mind blowing, right? Like it's got to be amazing. Now, I've recently started focusing more on Twitter as one channel, whereas before I would sort of spread myself thin. Oh, I've got to have this on Facebook. I've got to have this on Instagram too. I've got to have this on Twitter. I've got to put it on my YouTube channel. I've got to have it on all these places. Well, then you don't have any, you don't get to know the medium. You're competing with millions of people in that. And it's maybe some of them know the medium better than you do. And a lot of them are just by random chance are going to be lucky, and they're just going to naturally be better than you at it. And so this is why I think more about like, well, just get really good at this one medium and try to do it as well as you can. And so with something like for example, with Twitter is like trying to write a play while sitting on a stage where somebody else is performing another play. Like the box that people compose in is right there, and there's actually tweets coming in underneath the box. So, but you can cheat if you write your tweets separately in a different place, and you even might, you might spend like weeks on a tweet storm or on a tweet of like thinking that thing through. What about this one word? Is that the right word? What are the other words I could use? And to like dig deep on that, where you're spending hours on a tweet, and maybe it doesn't pay off for this one, but you do that enough and you start getting better at it. And I don't know, I could be wrong. This has been my main focus over the year, is just trying to write better tweets. And I've gotten better at it. I'm not a master. But if you're leveraging something, leverage is all about turning your force into more force. But if you're on something like Twitter, where you have a lot of competition, like you've got to have a lot of force, even though there's the leverage, because everybody else is using that same leverage. And so you just got to be really, really good at it. And so with content, it's a little bit, sometimes I worry that I'm fooling myself, because I have had those periods where I say, I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to write every morning a 500 word Medium post. I'm going to put it out there. And during those times, my platform has grown, and I've had some good ideas come from it as well. And I see people kind of like scaling their writing, where they make sure they're on LinkedIn, and this goes to Instagram too, and this goes. And so there could be a bit of a bias of, well, we're in the machine age. You just have to get your words into all the machines. There could be a little bit of that. But I also think like that if you can get past that local maximum, past that dip, somewhere beyond there, there is just the, well, you've got to be on Twitter, because that's the only place you're going to get Naval's tweets, because they're that good. Mm-hmm. Type of thing. So it depends on the game you're playing.
I have a question on in the pursuit of that perfect, brilliant tweet that's going to reach the most people. Is there, you actually mentioned this in the book too, I think his name's Dean Simonton. He did some research on quality, and it turns out Picasso painted thousands and thousands of paintings, and we only know a couple of them. So is there a trade-off or is there a better strategy between really meticulously crafting one piece of work, whether it's a tweet, whether it's a blog post, whether it's a podcast, or shipping really, really fast? Because one, maybe you get better through iteration. And two, maybe it's just really hard to predict what people want. And like, maybe you just have to like throw enough out there that like one resonates. Like, do you see, like, how do you see those two in terms of the dichotomy and in terms of like practice and art?
I've asked myself this so many times, and I guess my strategy is both is like spend time where you're worried about volume and then spend time where you're worried about quality. And in a way it is randomness. You're throwing spaghetti against the wall. You're trying to breed black swans. Mm-hmm. And a good way to do that is just more iterations, you're playing more hands of poker. I said rolling the dice once, but Adam Conover, who is a comedian, said he didn't like that analogy very much because it implies complete randomness. So maybe poker is a little better because you actually get, there's a little more skill, I think, involved in something like poker. And I think it's both. And certainly like with the Simonton research, there are counter examples. There are kind of always are. There's like Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. That was the only book that she completed in her life. The woman who wrote Gone with the Winds, like she did that and was like, no, I'm never writing anything again. Like that was horrible. And so part of it might be your personality. So like for myself, as somebody who still sometimes struggles with believing in himself, and I think for a lot of beginning writers, the volume thing helps because it helps remove that hesitation. Mm-hmm. Is that you're forcing yourself to sit down and write and publish things. And so you're building the muscle, not just for the writing, but also for the publishing, because that's a big thing to get through. Cause you can come up with a million reasons not to publish. And so I see it as three stages of being a writer is one, can I, and what I think I had a had anyway, like, can I write? Can I actually sit down and pump out words? Can I publish? Do I have the guts to put my work out there? And can I make it good is the final stage. I just recently started reading books about writing after finishing my third book and I realized that there's a lot of stuff I didn't know about writing that I probably wouldn't have written as much if I had known. Mm-hmm. And it's making me a better writer, but I can only get away with it because now I have the confidence.
Mm-hmm. David, so
I think I'm on the stage.
Go ahead. That the three stages of being a writer is really interesting to hear, because I actually had a different question that kind of set it up. But throughout this conversation, it's been this theme of arriving. And I feel like that's going to be your next book, Arriving by David Cataby versus Becoming by Michelle Obama. but you know, looking at my notes here, you mentioned looking at Warren Buffett's house and seeing that, oh, this went from 30K to 700K. Over how many decades, like passive income, you arrived at this learning to believe in yourself. And that seems to have filtered in to the rest of your life, where you felt confident enough to move to Chicago, move to Columbia, and even had this, I don't know if you'd call it a mission, but this idea of understanding that words are platform agnostic and you want to affect people's minds, which is inherently a long game to do. You don't do that overnight most of the time. And I know your book is about like mind management, helping people move away from these productivity hacks and focus more on kind of rewiring their brain essentially to think a different way. So in the same way you talked about the three stages of being a writer, how would you identify those stages of arriving to this point where you've learned to manage your mind versus, you know, feeling that time pressure of trying to do productivity hacks and doing something in the next minute and delivering something immediately? Like, what was your what were your stages of getting to that point?
Yeah, it was a little bit for trial by fire, I think, because I had a book deal and I didn't have to believe in myself too much because I at least had a publisher who believed in me and gave me money and created that pressure. And I would have really struggled to write that first book without that vote of confidence. But then once I started trying to do it, I realized it was really hard to write a book in 6 months when you haven't written a book before.
Yikes.
It would be hard to do it now. And at the time I had a lot of desperation to prove myself. That was important fuel, and I got by with that. And I think that's why I couldn't repeat it now, because I don't feel a need to prove myself to anybody really anymore. So I wouldn't feel as motivated to do it. But it was just in that process of writing that I realized that I was banging my head against the wall 12 hours a day, and I would just have these moments where suddenly the writing would come easily, and within 15 minutes I would have like a whole chapter written. And I thought, well, if that took 15 minutes and all day I was doing pretty much nothing, like, why couldn't I just sit down and do that? And so I guess I'm kind of glad that I had the pressure there to allow me to discover what that felt like. Hopefully with my book, I can avoid some other people having to find themselves in a situation like that in order to discover this. So I think first thing was just trying to find that moment when the creative work would come easily. And part of that was also just letting go of, like Ali was talking about, that you can't just sit down and do the research and have the output come all at once. And having that permission, having that, being comfortable with that, that you are going to sit down and you're just going to like write some notes about sort of the facts of what you're dealing with or whatever sort of thoughts you have going on about this thing. And you're going to accept that a lot of it's going to be wrong and it's going to be really poorly written, et cetera. Just being comfortable with that is a huge load off of your nervous system, which if you have a load on your nervous system is going to be a blocker to creativity. So I think that's the number one thing. So if I were to make it three things, then it would be, well, finding your sweet spot, respecting the four stages of creativity, which we can talk about, but I talked about in the book, which is just accepting that you're not going to sit down and do it all at once. And then after that, I would say it is recognizing the cycles, that happen in your work, whether that is your shipping schedule or the way that the rhythm of your energy works throughout the week, or seasonal variations in your particular business, things like that. So if I were to break down the three, those would be my three. I'm gonna disappear for 1 second.
Did you guys, the creative sweet spot is such a cool idea, because I feel like it's very difficult to have like a fully, I guess, event-based calendar as opposed to a time-based one, especially if you work at a big company like HubSpot. You've got a bunch of meetings, obligations, deadlines, et cetera. But it feels like the creative sweet spot is something that pretty much anybody could do, especially since it's typically early in the morning, at least according to your book, that is the sweet spot in terms of the grogginess to get into that creative brainwave state. So do you still follow that? Do you write every morning? Do you don't drink coffee? You just wake up and put pen to paper?
I'm currently slightly more relaxed now that I've finished a book that I've been working on for so long. But yeah, every morning time is certainly the time that I try to that I try to write, and I see it as, well, if I don't write now, then I'm probably not going to write a lot later. So that kind of doesn't go away. It continues to be important for me, but when I do have other priorities going on, like as I'm promoting this book, for example, or preparing the audiobook, sometimes I'll let it something else take priority over it. Or if it's something that's like incredibly unpleasant that I need to do, that I don't have that I need to have enough mental energy to motivate myself to do, sometimes I'll make a little bit of a carve out a little bit of an area for that. But kind of like David's Deep Work Wednesday, my Mondays and Tuesdays are pretty much no meetings. I just try not to schedule anything, just because to really get lost in something and to not feel any need to watch your clock at all is incredibly valuable. I think it's, and this is something where I think my behavior sometimes mystifies people, because I place so much emphasis on that. Like, just for example, I had somebody offering me money to like write 4 articles a month for a few months, and I could like use content that I already had, and I like turned it down, and it wasn't bad money, but I turned it down simply because I didn't want to have that obligation taking up any mental space. And so while there are ideas such as an aspirational hourly rate, you can also place almost like a dollar value on certain mental states. And that can be very high sometimes. And it can be kind of seemingly inconsequential things that can intrude on that. Another thing I recently decided was that I'm not going to do talks. I'm not going to do a presentation. If somebody invites me to a conference, unless it's like, I don't know, it could be negotiable, but I don't have a presentation I don't have a slide deck that's ready to go. And part of it is just that while I have spoken around the world, I don't like having a talk coming up. Like, there's just this sort of like low level anxiety that takes over. We're like thinking about this thing, this event that's going to happen. And like, yeah, it's only going to take you 20 minutes or something, but it is, it's taking up like CPU. I think I saw Shane Parrish tweet something about that, about working with people you can't trust is like running with 25% of your CPU, you know, taken up by some other program. Mm-hmm. So there's these mental load considerations to think about too.
So Ali, you and I have talked about this with work that feels like an obligation or work that kind of sucks energy away. It's not just that it sucks energy away in that moment that you're doing the work, or even before it, like even with the looming anxiety, but actually after the fact, I actually find myself less interested in the work that I want to be doing. So it's a total drain. Like, and it's something that you can justify by saying, it's just a 30-minute meeting, like whatever, let's do this, put it on the calendar. But it's got reverberating effects both before and after that event. So it really is like the capital that you have allotted for your actual mindset and your mind space, like you're taking away from that finite pool there.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that it is a, it's something that plays into decisions a lot. And it's something that I struggle with and actively try to mitigate, which is like almost opportunity costs or loss aversion, where there might be things where I'm making money and it might actually, I'll just take an example. I had one of the passive income sites that I set up when I moved to Chicago, that eventually made me money, that really like made the Design for Hackers stuff possible. I made like $150,000 passively. It was continuing to make me a little bit of money, like a tiny amount, but I didn't have to do anything. But I thought about it and I was like, I should just kill this thing. Cause it wasn't, it didn't feed anything that I wanted to learn about. It didn't feed into any of my long-term goals. And while I wasn't actively thinking about it, I felt like it was taking up some mental real estate, and that maybe I felt like it was maybe a safety net for me as well. And it even, I even had friends who were like, you know, this domain's got pretty good authority. It says you should sell this domain. You should sell the site or whatever. I'm like, well, I don't want to learn how to do those things because it's not a thing that I'm going to do in the future. And so to just go into WP Engine and like turn off the site and just let the domain expire and ignore all the emails from Namecheap regarding it was tough. I think it was the right thing to do. And I'm finding myself in this situation where the mantra that I have for myself is to burn your boats. This is supposedly some kind of military strategy or some strategy that maybe it was Cortez used it, where they arrive in the new world and they scuttle the ships, which in some cases you burn the ships, which is just basically saying you're not going back. So something about that image like helps me through those cases where I wonder to myself, like, okay, well, I'm gaining something here. And it's even harder to do when it's something that you already have. Because I think that's loss aversion taking over there too, is like, you already have it. Mm-hmm. It's already making you something, but it's taken up just a little bit of whatever you've got, and you've got to cut it out. It's hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
So true.
Do you believe in rituals and habits? Like, do you have a set miracle morning or something like that in kind of the Tim Ferriss
productivity exist.
Stuff?
Yeah, I try to, I guess, come up with sequences for things that I do regularly. Like when I moved into this apartment, and kind of set my new routine living with my partner, I wrote down like exact steps of getting up in the morning, you know, doing whatever my routine is, like something like 80 some steps before I like get to sitting here at this desk and writing. Mm-hmm. And actually wrote them down and thought about, okay, well, wait, which one is, cause just simply writing it down, you think, oh, well, actually it would be more efficient if I did this before I did that. And it's part of it's an intellectual exercise, but I also find that when you have those steps to follow and you consult that, it gets programmed into your, basal ganglia. So you're just not using that energy. So I use that sort of stuff is systematized. I mean, we have a cooking system, which is basically like same stuff pretty much every day, like mixed in, you know, there's some combinations that we make different, but like it takes 10 minutes or something to make a meal. And it's just routine, just goes on totally on repeat, which a lot of people find super boring. But just anything I can do to reduce any having to think about stuff that I don't want to think about.
I want to build a morning routine again. I used to do this, but it kind of made me stressed out because it was too rigid. So when I would travel and not be able to do it, I would kind of feel extra stressed and extra anxious. And I'm like, well, this is kind of a fragile system. So I want to build in a little bit more robustness, a little bit more flexibility. And that's why I like your book seems really crucial and really like aligned with this, because you can set aside your morning for creative work and leave it spacious. You can set aside afternoons for sort of synthesizing and editing things. And then it seems like evenings and nights for collection, reading, researching, and all of that stuff. So if I have these broad buckets, then I can be a little bit more flexible with how I like do the incremental, minute activities within that. But back in the old day when I was super obsessed with like the, you know, optimization, biohacking, all that stuff. I had this like, you know, it's like read for 30 minutes, bulletproof coffee, meditate for 10 minutes. And if I miss a step, it would feel, I don't know, it would feel extra, yeah, guilty or something like that. So
toxic productivity. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, there's a balance.
There's one thing I started doing actually like a couple weeks ago. I have been waking up and just like on my email right away. And some emails I've been receiving are not the best thing to start your morning with. So I will leave my phone at home and just go on a walk, which I know we discussed the value of walks, but it's like 20 degrees here in Chicago. So I'm like bundled up with the coffee. And before I leave, I like take a look at what I'm doing that day. And then I just like think through the day. Like I spend some mental energy on work. So then I'm like, oh, I'm working, but it doesn't feel like very heavy work because I'm just like, okay, this is what I'm writing about today. Like, how do I feel about this? Like, I have to work on this thing. And it's such a good way to start the day. And maybe I'm late to the game here, but it feels good not to even listen to a podcast or listen to music and just like exist. And it's dead outside because it's freezing. And it just feels like you feel so refreshed. And then by the time you get to your desk, you feel like prepared, but you don't, you know, you start fresh. You don't have anything ready to go. So you're just like, you're not rolling out of bed and walking into the office, which sadly I have done many times.
The email, I feel like I don't even get that many emails, but I treat my email inbox like I'm like disarming a bomb almost. When I open it, I like mentally prepare myself to not react to whatever I'm going to see and to be ready to just sort of triage things. I just create all these filters and stuff. So like anybody who like wants to be in my podcast, it just like automatically goes, I just like don't see it. Yeah. I don't even have guests, things like that. But it can be, I think it's helpful to like collect things and to have that ability to think about things. That's what I've found with, I'm on day 89 now of meditating an hour a day in the morning, nice. Naval thing. I did the 60 days. I'm on 89. Either tomorrow, I might not do it tomorrow, actually. Like, I don't want it to be become this big streak thing. Like, oh, I got to 90 days or like, I'm not going to do it soon, but I have found that even though I'm sort of giving up an hour a day, the things I do, I do them a lot more crisply. Mm-hmm. And I don't waste as much energy, I think, doing things that don't matter.
Are you purposefully breaking the streak so you don't feel obligated to continue it? Or why are you not doing it?
Yes.
Just to, okay. I feel like I've done Duolingo so many days in a row that I have to do it now, even if I don't want to continue learning this language.
And it's, yeah, like, I think that's how they get
psychological
gamification, the gamification, yeah, aspect of it for sure.
Yeah.
I like that idea of purposefully breaking it.
Right. And this is one of the reasons why I liked Naval's sort of no effort meditation from the beginning, is that I have realized that meditation can be a toxic productivity thing. It's just like another thing for me to feel bad that I didn't do it right, or I didn't have a good session today. And I did string together 60 days, mostly because I'm just curious about the neuroplasticity effects that, like, you kind of have to string together days to really see what the effects are of something like that. But I don't want it to become some sort of streak thing. So I might start not doing it tomorrow.
I love that. Maybe I'll break my Duolingo streak too.
I think
this could be a thing. Streak breaking, just like streak protest thing. I'm just like, I'm not gonna.
There's an anti-optimization movement afoot.
Yeah, I kind of like this.
David, that the first time you mentioned toxic productivity, I think we all were like, oh yeah, like, that thing. and the big takeaway I'm getting from this, at least in the short term, is like being aware of that. Like, we might feel pressured to like complete some task or do some project or whatever, and then at the end, while we're doing it, we might ask ourselves, like, is this actually being productive? And is this actually a net negative on my productivity doing this task, or like productivity in terms of my mindset and my mental health? And will this actually ruin my day if I try to stress out and finish this thing? I think that's something I'm going to revisit after this conversation.
Yeah, I feel like there's when you get sort of a rejection of productivity or a revolt against productivity. There's one school that's sort of like, oh, isn't that so sad that if you're everything in life is to make yourself more productive. But I think that that's like the wrong way to think about it. Mm-hmm. Because it's sad if everything you do in life is to be more productive so you can like make somebody else rich or, meet the quarterly goals so shareholders are happy sort of thing. Like, that's fucking sad. But if you have something that you do that means something to you, then it's not sad at all to have everything in your life kind of feed into your productivity. And so I think that's a good question is like, is this thing that feels productive actually productive? It's actually counterproductive to this thing that is important to me.
I want to follow up with kind of a related one. So let's say I'm working on something meaningful, important for my own business, but I want to work more. So like there's probably a certain amount of hours I can stretch creative work out in a day. I think maybe some have estimated 2 hours, 4 hours, depending on like what task you're doing. Is there a role for nootropics to stretch that, to give me a little boost? Can I take modafinil, Adderall, a bulletproof coffee, or am I fooling myself by doing that?
I do not have the answer. I think for like a small stretch, it can be helpful. I tried modafinil once. You can get it over the counter here in Colombia.
True.
And I wrote one of my most popular articles ever, but I haven't done it again. And that was years ago. I have little nicotine lozenges. I try to do maybe one a week.
I do the same thing.
Get habituated. I'm very sensitive to caffeine. It's not a good one for me. So even if I have like a green tea in the morning, in the afternoon, I'll be anxious, or maybe even the next day, something. If I use something like that, it's probably not going to be to extend my time. It'll probably be more to enhance. But I certainly think a lot about recovering, just mentally recovering, changing my body position. I've got a reclining chair. I stand up, like move around, go for walks. If I go for a walk, I might listen to a podcast, or I'm working on my audiobook now. I'll listen to my audiobook while I go for a walk. So I'll sort of multi-channel, multitask in that way. I've got a hammock. I'll go lay there. Just like trying to find a way to mix things up so that I can sort of work longer, but I'm not overstressing my body or my mind in such a way that, yeah, I worked more today, but tomorrow I'm useless. Type of thing.
There's no free lunch, essentially. Like, you're taking something away from the next day or your own body's energy levels, essentially.
Yeah, I think so. And I that's the way I think of it. No free lunch. Yeah, I think that is a good way to think about it. I'm not a doctor or physiologist of any kind. I don't know. I'm not qualified to answer a question like that. But the way that I think about it is that whatever I'm taking, even if I'm working on a book, and I'm working on it for years, which I just finished one, I'm like taking it way easier now because I'm trying to recover from that. I'm trying to like open my mind again and step back so that I can hopefully find whatever my next big idea is. And it's like, yeah, you're drawing from a pool that replenishes, but if you keep drawing from it more and more and more to the point that like it doesn't replenish, then you got a problem. It's almost like, oh yeah, I was thinking about this the other day. Like, you can drive your car until the oil light comes on, but as I understand it, once that happens, you've like screwed up your car. But if you like change the oil before the oil light comes on, well, you can go for years and years and years. So like trying to avoid hitting that point where you just burn out, is what I'm kind of always trying to do.
It seems like your whole approach is going with the flow of like human behavior and environmental factors. Whereas a lot of what I see in Silicon Valley is sort of like fighting uphill against bad habits that shouldn't be there in the first place. It's like, oh, I'll just drink Soylent to like power through lunch. I'm getting no sunlight, so I'll like take a bunch of nootropics and supplements to like chemically balance that out. I'm tired because I was coding all night trying to stretch it on, so I'm just going to like IV some caffeine. And it's like, well, wait. Instead of doing all that, how about we just get some sun, get some sleep, and like go with our actual brain waves? It seems more of a naturalistic approach.
And if you talk to most of those people, they're all working from the same mental source code, and they have their heads up their asses. They're just like, it's like why I had to leave Silicon Valley was because every conversation, it's almost like this alternate reality gets created in any culture. They just create their own matrix where there's these certain thought patterns or ways of deciding what is true or important in the world. Maybe it's values that it could be that. And if you can step outside of it, you just see like, okay, yeah, you're like working really hard. You stayed up all night coding that thing. That's actually a really terrible idea. That isn't going to be anything. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I'm jaded. I've been at it too long or something, but I think part of it also is trying to be aware that I'm probably fooling myself in some way. And like the more time that I can spend away from things, I can maybe fool myself a little bit less. And it's different if you already have the plan and you have to execute this thing. And for whatever reason, you know, maybe you have to push things a little harder. And that's what I do when I write a book is I'm trying to replenish myself, but I go through these longer projects where you just push yourself a little harder, maybe than you should. And that's just kind of the nature of my personality sometimes, but I try to mitigate it when I can.
I've definitely found, I've read all the productivity books and articles and, you know, kind of went down that rabbit hole, and I found your approach remarkably refreshing and it resonated, I think, with all of us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that is good to hear.
David, do you have any more questions? Otherwise, I have normally a list of kind of rapid fire overrated, underrated ones, but I actually only want to ask one. Well, two, actually.
Cool.
I'm not going to do the whole list of overrated, underrated, but because you lived in Chicago for a long time, I got to ask a couple related to that. So Gino's East.
I don't eat pizza, unfortunately.
Oh, so overrated for sure. My next one is deep dish pizza.
Pizza's good. Pizza is really delicious. There's like three things I can eat. My health just sucks. And so I just can't.
We'll just do a pass on that one. Wait, so yeah. Can I ask about bandeja paisa?
Bandeja paisa?
Yeah.
I also can't really eat that. I don't know.
Oh, damn. All right. So my overrated, underrated segment is.
Paisa is good.
Anyways. Arepas, yeah. Overrated, underrated.
It's so hard, you know.
Like then you got to pick whether it's Venezuelan or Colombian.
Some of them are really bad, you know. Like when you first have an arepa and it's like as hard as a hockey puck. And then there's other ones that are really good. So underrated.
Underrated in America, at least. I believe in the States we don't see those too often. So. I'll just do the rapid fire ones, since all of my questions were kind of food related, it seems like on the overrated.
Yeah, I don't really eat food. So
just Soylent.
Only Soylent. So, yeah.
I have like I eat like the natural equivalent to Soylent, basically. I probably couldn't tolerate Soylent. So
it's the worst. I tried it for a little bit. It's not good.
I love the idea. I find eating very inconvenient. So I like the idea of Soylent, but I don't practice. Too.
Who do you admire professionally and why?
Nobody. Just kidding. professionally. What does professionally mean? Like that they're really good at it, or they're good at it and they do it ethically, or that they're
just whose work do you admire, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. That makes it a lot easier. I'd say right now I've been consuming a lot of Nassim Taleb's work. I think that it's important to the challenge that we have of trying to navigate uncertainty and do creative work and recognize that we're harnessing randomness. We don't know what's going to work. Basically that.
Do you have a favorite Nassim Taleb book?
I feel like I almost came to appreciate them after reading them. And so I almost need to reread them, but I'd say right now, since I recently did a Black Swan summary, that I would say the Black Swan, mostly because I think that that's what, as a creator or as a writer, I'm trying to do. And I think that's what I have done without necessarily knowing it in the past is, you know, you write a blog post and you start a blog and, you know, you get moved to Silicon Valley, or you write a blog post and you get a book deal, or you write another blog post and then Dan Ariely reaches out to you and you work on a productivity app together and you sell it to Google. Out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of attempts, only some of them actually work out. And I think that that's a very important thing that a lot of people don't think about.
Yeah, that influenced me a lot in terms of how I look at A/B testing when I was doing experimentation, and also with our content approach. We've obviously built out the barbell strategy where we do a lot of, predictable stuff and then try to capture the serendipitous upside of that 20% basket as well. But in A/B testing, it taught me you can't really predict the magnitude or the amplitude of a given win. So you want to get as many sort of cheap experiments or cheap iterations as you can out there, so you can be surprised by the ones that you weren't expecting to give you that huge lift. And I think it's similar with creative work. You don't know which one is going to be that huge serendipitous result.
And I think it ties in with, like, I've had a vendetta against A/B testing for a really long time. I actually have an article that's relatively popular where I ran AA tests for 8 months on just like the same subject line, same email on MailChimp for 8 months. And I compiled it all and just showed, like, look at all the effects I found of how I like increased conversion, whatever. And I think that was like maybe my best expression of my problem with A/B testing. But I think that that's part of it as well, is that you're not like comparing apples to apples here. I mean, look at, like, the reason we even connected was because you wrote the barbell strategy article. I'm not going to say that I'm a black swan. Who knows what will come of this relationship, but I assume you don't get a lot of traffic, inbound search traffic to that article, because nobody's searching for that. But I am. Well, so it's like, that's, I'm one person on your analytics, but here we are having this, you know, 2 hour long conversation or whatever, thanks to the article that you wrote.
We brought literally this point up about this article in our Slack channel, because we had a previous article that David wrote about D2C content marketing, and we got a lead from that, even though there's no search volume, no traffic on it. But the people who were searching were so qualified, so high intent, that it was worth writing that article because it was so specific, but we couldn't have predicted that before.
And if I can keep expanding, like David mentioned the long game about influencing people's thoughts. That's something that doesn't show up in analytics, is that you can increase the attention that you get, like, oh, you got more page views, you got more likes on this thing. And then maybe somewhere down the road, you got more actions, like people, you got more leads or something, but there's the black box that happens, and that happens while people sleep, while they're in their shower, while they're talking to other people. It can take days and years and months for that influence to actually occur. And And the fewer risks you take, the more you're going for the middle, the more you're going for, let's make sure we get the page views and the, you know, the output for our input, the less you're going to take the risks that it takes to actually affect people's thoughts.
I love it. That seems like a good place to wrap up here. So as we're winding down, do you have any places you'd like to point people to online, your website? Obviously, check out your book, Mind Management, Not Time Management.
Yeah, sign up for my newsletter. I've got a newsletter called Love Mondays. This is where I kind of navigate or share my ideas on how to navigate this extremist and world of being a creator. You can find that at Kadavy.net. And then I'm on Twitter at @Kadavy. And I'm on the other ones, but I don't care about those.